One of the expressions of power in our family is our ability to remove canning lids from jars. Now, the average family might just use a can opener, and it's not like we don't have a can opener. It's just that at some point I chose to show my manhood by popping canning jar lids off. Why be conventional? Anybody can use a can opener. Take something special to do it with your fingernails. Let me tell you how it's done, just in case you want to go home and try this. See, the whole idea of a canning jar is that you form a vacuum seal in it, and that lid is sucked onto that jar so tight that the food inside of it doesn't spoil. Well, in order to get the lid off, I just simply put about four fingernails under the lid and apply steady pressure. It doesn't take a lot of pressure, but it takes pressure. And it's, you just hold that pressure, and sometimes it happens soon, and sometimes it takes long enough that you say, "Oh, fooey on it," and get a can opener. But if you hold that pressure on that canning jar lid, it will come off. Because it's not designed to work in like a reverse effort. It's designed to just hold the vacuum that it has and to stay there. So you can try that at home in your spare time. I was going to bring a jar and I actually forgot, but then I decided if I had one, I wasn't sure what I would do with the fruit or vegetables once it was open, so no big loss. I didn't bring one. You'll have to try it on your own. This analogy somewhat reminds me of what's going on in our country right now, and in many parts of the world for that matter. And it doesn't relate to canning jars. It relates to the morals and values that we see declining in our country. We see that obedience or adherence to law of any kind is declining. And if we don't like the law, we just go ahead and take action to change that law. I've been troubled for some time, as I know many of you are, or most of, or maybe probably all of you better be, about the sidelining of God in our country over the past many years. It's ongoing. It's subtle. It's like the pressure on that canning lid that you just hold on to it. You just watch. It's going to pop. One of these days it's going to pop. It was June 25th, 1962, that the Supreme Court ruled that prayer was unconstitutional in schools. As I've read and listened, that was an unpopular decision. People in general didn't agree with that. They held on and said, "No, this top's not going to pop off of here. We're going to keep the lid on, and we're going to believe in God and Bible, and we're going to do this, and we're going to have prayer in school." That was 1962. I was 4 years old, 51 years ago. Or 52, or I don't know, I can't remember. I remember in grade school that we had a moment of silence. And I went, "Oh, this is cool. You know, don't have to." Well, I sort of remember praying in school in that moment of silence. But it was like the further I went in school, it was like it was more macho. We didn't have moments of silence anymore. It, pretty much you just come to school and get busy. Well, then the effort began to rid God out of the textbooks. And that has been going pretty good. They've managed to pretty much get God out of everything. Creationism went out the door, and maybe it's an alternative, but it's certainly just a theory in comparison to evolution. So eventually we've run God out of the schools. Who in the schools? Now we have policemen in our schools, so we don't need God. I didn't take the time to exactly figure out when we started ruling Ten Commandment plaques or monuments as being a bad thing. It could have been in 1980 in Stone versus Graham, when the court ruled that the Ten Commandments promoted religion, and suddenly that wasn't acceptable. So the high court said, "Nope, can't do that." People don't want to be reminded that there's someone greater than themselves telling them what to do. This has hit home in North Idaho there. Standpoint has a monument of the Ten Commandments on a public park, and there's been pressure for that to go away. Well, so far, it seems like it's still there. I believe it's there, but it, in my opinion, won't last because the pressure on that lid just keeps being applied. And eventually, the people that are in that battle to keep it there, they'll have to relent and they'll have to move it to private property, and then the battle will be over for the time being. The Spokane Faith and Values website has some comments posted on their website, Spokane Faith and Values, about that standpoint display. So here's a representation of how people feel about God in their lives. No particular specific religious belief has any place in a public venue. Enjoy your beliefs in private. Okay, that's one person's opinion. Another person wrote, displaying the Ten Commandments is a way that government endorses one religious belief over others. And it goes on. In other words, don't talk to me about right and wrong. I don't want to hear it. I'm not going to listen. And even if you tell me, I'm not going to do it. Brethren, this is a dangerous society we're in. That lid is going to come off one of these days. It's certainly, pressure is being applied. It's not a good scene that we're into. So God has been fairly successfully removed from marriage and the family, except in certain enclaves. Hopefully this is one of them. And even that is tough. The goal is to remove any reference about God from vows. Why would you want God in your marriage? And since we don't want to start marriage out with a lie, let's make sure he's not in it from the beginning. And this is not the way to start a marriage. We don't want God in our marriage, so it's just best not to even have God anywhere in the marriage or around the marriage. It used to be that when you walked into someone's house, you'd undoubtedly see a Bible laying fairly prominently. Now you'll see an iPad, TV guide or whatever guide, you know, the world has changed and we're trying to hold the faith once delivered. In general, people don't like being told what to do, and again, they're not going to do it. Now the interesting thing is, the greater the number of people that don't submit, that don't want to follow these rules, the more pressure is applied to those who do want to apply the rules and keep the laws. And that affects us here also, because everybody, as we look around the world, people are not keeping the law, and we are trying to be law keepers, and we're trying to do what God tells us, and we're trying to have a good attitude about it, but there is a lot of pressure telling us otherwise. Most people want to do what they want to do, they want to do as they please, and the attitude is, and who is God, and who does he think he is to tell me what to do? And why would I want to comply with a bunch of rules? Hopefully I'll try to answer some of these things or allude to them as we go along. So I'm going to try to show you that we're not all that much different than the Israelites were. It's slightly different. It's different and it's the same. It's anybody that's the human mind does not want to follow God. And they didn't want to follow God. But let's take a look at what their life was like. Exodus 5 in verse 1, I'm going to kind of paraphrase, Mike Imes paraphrased this. Exodus 5 in verse 1. So Moses and Aaron go to Pharaoh and they say, let my people go so that we can go worship God in the wilderness. And Pharaoh says, who is the Lord? No way, you're not going anywhere. And they say, please let us go 3 days into the desert and so we can sacrifice. And Pharaoh says, you people have too much time on your hands. Get back to work. So Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters to not only keep making the same number of bricks that they had to go gather the straw now as well. In verse 15, the officers of the children of Israel cry out to Pharaoh saying, why? Why did you do this to us? And Pharaoh says, you're idle. You say, let's go sacrifice to the Lord. Bah humbug. Get to work. Verse 21, and the Israelites said to Moses and Aaron, you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and the sight of his servants to put a sword in their hand to kill us. You're trying to kill us. Just leave us alone and let us do what we want to do. But you can see that Pharaoh had the power. Pharaoh had all the power. So who is Pharaoh? Pharaoh is an ancient Egyptian king. Pharaoh is a person who uses his authority to oppress others. He's a tyrant. His actions aren't fair. He doesn't care about fair. He depends on what he wants to do. It's government by man, kind of like it is today. I tried to look up Egyptian law. I'm not a historian, but I do have the internet to assist me. With the internet, you can be an expert on anything. As you can imagine, writing down the law back then was kind of tricky. God was, I don't want to say desperate, but he had to use his finger to write on the stone. Most people just use hammer and a chisel. So it would take a while to come up with documents like we have today. So there might have been some written rules at some point, but in general, the Pharaoh had the ultimate power. And no God, not big G, not little G, no God was going to tell him what to do. The ancient history encyclopedia has this to say under the article Pharaoh, that's ancient history encyclopedia, that Pharaoh was a political and religious leader. So both sides of the fence, you had to submit to Pharaoh. As supreme ruler of the people, the Pharaoh was considered a god on earth, the intermediary between the gods and the people. And when he died, he was thought to become Osiris, the god of the dead. As such, in his role of the high priest of every temple, it was Pharaoh's duty to build great temples and monuments celebrating his own achievements and paying homage to the gods of the land. He was all about self-promotion. Build me a bigger, better, get my name on the front of it. That's what he wanted. The Pharaoh made the laws. He owned the land. He collected the taxes. He made the war. The rulers of Egypt were usually the sons or declared heirs of the preceding Pharaoh, born of the great wife, which was Pharaoh's chief consort, or maybe a lesser-ranked wife with whom Pharaoh favored. The chief responsibility of the Pharaoh was to maintain Maya, that's universal harmony in the country. The goddess Maya, Mayet, was thought to work her will through the Pharaoh, but it was up to the individual ruler to interpret the goddess's will correctly and then to act on it. So basically he got to do what he wanted to do. Accordingly, wealth warfare was an essential aspect of the rule of Pharaoh, especially when it was seen as necessary for the restoration of balance and harmony in the land. So if you want to create harmony, you just start another war, take over some more people, kill somebody. That's man's system. Man thinks the way to peace is war. And we've talked about this before, but they had lots of gods, maybe 2,000 gods, maybe 8,700 gods. It depends on how you count gods. Towns and regions each had their own god. So west side of town wouldn't know what the east side of town was doing. People had gods for dogs and cats and chickens, and pregnant women had their own gods, and everybody had their own gods. Village A might have a god of the dogs, but that would be a different god than Village B, god of the dogs. So it was very strange, but just the more gods, the merrier. Some of these gods look like people. Some of them look like mixtures of people and animals and some other created things, animal bodies, combinations of odd features. However, they thought they should look. So they made images based to represent their gods to be in whatever likeness they wanted to. So when you think of the Ten Commandments, and it says, don't make any images, don't make any graven images, don't make any likeness of anything, God knew what he was saying when they did that. How different the true God is. So when God came along, he said, don't make pictures, don't make images. That's very different. That's a different concept for the Israelites. They're not used to that. God, the Creator God, shows himself through great power, through signs and wonders, through fire and cloud. He was very different than the gods of Egypt. Let's turn to Deuteronomy 4 in verse 1 through 40. 1 through 40? Really? What we're going to see here is God says, there's one God, and I'm the only God, and there is no other God. There's one way to do this thing. Deuteronomy 4, verse 1. Now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and judgments which I teach you to observe, that you may live. So God is setting it up that you listen to me and do what I say, and you're going to live. And you'll be able to go into and possess the land which the Lord your God, which the Lord God of your fathers is giving you. You shall not add to the words which I command you, nor take away from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you. I am commanding you. I'm not suggesting it. I'm not giving you options to change it. I'm not saying wait for the next election cycle so that you can figure out what you want to do next time. Verse 3, your eyes have seen what the Lord did in Baal-peor, for the Lord your God has destroyed from among you all the men who followed Baal of Peor. And you can reference and go over to Numbers 25 on your own, and you'll see that the Israelites committed harlotry, and God killed 24,000 of them. And if it weren't for the action of one man, the death toll would have kept going. But one man took a stand, and he said, that's it. And he pinned the lovemakers to the ground with his spear, and he said, that's it. And God had mercy and stopped the plague. Verse 4, but you who held fast to the Lord your God are alive today, every one of you. And isn't that interesting that today we sit here, stand here in this hall, and there are many that have been with us that are not with us because they did not stand and they did not hold fast to what God was doing in their lives. Verse 5, surely I have taught you statutes and judgments just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should act according to them in the land which you go to possess. Therefore, be careful to observe them. Don't be sloppy. Don't be carefree. Don't be trying to make up your own. Be careful to observe them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples. You who hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. We want people to say that about us. Don't we all like, wow, you know, that guy really has his act together. He knows what he's doing. And some would say, and God is blessing him. And God really, he has favor in God's eyes. Verse 7, for what great nation is there that has God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us? For whatever reason we may call upon him. So we are supposed to have a relationship with God, and we are supposed to be able to call on him, and he is to be near to us. And what great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are in all this law which I set before you this day? This isn't like Egypt and Pharaoh where he just makes it up on a daily whim, and depending on whether he has a stomach ache or not, he decides to wipe out a bunch of people or create a new law or whatever it may be. These are statutes and judgments that are righteous. Verse 9, only take heed to yourselves, and diligently keep yourselves, lest you forget the things your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life. And teach them to your children and to your grandchildren. This is a problem for some of us that it's hard to transmit these things to young people. The young people need to see these things modeled in the parents' lives, and we all have baggage, and we're all trying to work through the issues of life, and our children pick up on that. We have to teach our children and our grandchildren. In verse 10, especially concerning the day you stood before the Lord your God in Horeb and said, when the Lord said to me, gather the people to me, and I will let them hear my words, that they may learn to fear me all the days they live on the earth. Learn to fear me all the days they live on the earth, that they may teach their children. Then you came near and stood on the mount or the foot of the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire to the midst of heaven, with darkness, cloud, and thick darkness. And the Lord spoke to you out of the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of the words, but you saw no form. You only heard a voice. As opposed to what they were used to in Egypt, where 8,700 gods and any design you wanted, was kind of a free-for-all. You saw no form. You heard only a voice. So he declared you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform. That is, the Ten Commandments. And he wrote them on two tablets of stone. And the Lord commanded me at that time to teach you statutes and judgments, that you might observe them in the land which you cross over to possess. Verse 15. Take careful heed to yourselves, for you saw no form when God spoke to you at Horeb out of the midst of the fire, lest you act corruptly and make for yourselves a carved image in the form of any figure, the likeness of male or female, the likeness of any beast that is on the earth, or the likeness of any winged bird that flies in the air, the likeness of anything that creeps on earth, or the likeness of any fish that is in the water beneath the earth. And take heed, lest you lift your eyes to heaven, and when you see the sun, the moon, and the stars, all the host of heaven, you feel driven to worship them and serve them. That's what they were used to. And brethren, does our society have anything like that? Do we have the God of Ford and Chevy and Android and iPhone and maybe the gods and goddesses of sex and comedy and snowmobiles and race cars and entertainment and fashion and position? Do we have anything that gets us off track? Do we have things that we put in our own image? Every town, it seems, has something that they broadcast. Maybe it's, this is a ski town, this is a race town, this is a whatever town, and all these different towns have their own little gods they want people to serve and throw money to, come in various shapes and compositions and all manner of odd adoration. Verse 20, when the Lord has taken you and brought you out of the iron furnace, out of Egypt, to be his people, his inheritance, as you are this day. We have to remember that. God took us out of the world, and he set us, he's washed us up, and he's put us in his church. And he said, here, this is a better way. Verse 21, furthermore, the Lord was angry with me for your sakes, and swore that I would not cross over the Jordan, and I would not enter the good land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. But I must die in this land. I must not cross over the Jordan, but you shall cross over and possess that good land. Moses knew better. He had sinned greatly before God, and God couldn't allow Moses to go into the promised land because Moses hadn't given God the respect and obedience that he deserved. Verse 22, take heed to yourselves, lest you forget the covenant of the Lord your God, which he made with you, and make for yourselves a carved image in the form of anything which the Lord your God has forbidden you. For the Lord your God is a consuming fire, a jealous God. There is only one God. And he's saying, you worship me and none other. When you beget children and grandchildren and have grown old in the land, act corruptly and make a carved image in any form of anything, and do evil in the sight of the Lord your God to provoke him to anger, I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day that you will soon utterly perish from the land you have crossed over the Jordan to possess. You will not prolong your days in it, but will be utterly destroyed. The same applies to us. You're going to get away with this. You're going to get away with sin. You're going to get away with ignoring me and doing your own thing. But judgment day is coming, and it will be difficult one of these days, and you are going to lose your life over it. And verse 27, and the Lord will scatter you among the peoples, and you will be left few in number among the nations where the Lord will drive you. And there you will serve gods, the work of men's hands, wood and stone. God knew these people. He knew what their background was, and he knows how hard it is to get the leaven out and how hard it is to keep doing the right thing. Wooden stone which men neither see nor hear, nor eat nor smell. But from there you will seek, from your captivity, you will seek the Lord your God, and you will find him if you seek him with all your heart and with all your soul. So you can go into the captivity, you can go make your mistakes, you can go create havoc in your life, and God is right there. He's right where you left him, and you'll be able to come back to God with all your baggage and be able to go ahead and serve him, but you're going to have to make greater effort, and it's going to be harder. Verse 30, when you are in distress and all these things come upon you in the latter days, when you turn to the Lord your God and obey his voice, for the Lord your God is merciful, is a merciful God. He will not forsake you, nor destroy you, nor forget the covenant of your fathers which he swore to them. It is amazing how merciful and gracious God is. When he tells them what he wants them to do, he says, I know you're not going to do it, but I'll be there when you come to your senses, you know, kind of like the prodigal son. I'll be here. Just know this is how it's going to go. Verse 32, for ask now concerning the days that are past, which were set before you since the day that God created man on the earth, and ask from one end of heaven to the other whether any great thing like this has happened or anything like it has been heard. Did any people ever hear the voice of God speaking out in the midst of fire as you have heard and lived? Did any of your 8,700 gods in Egypt ever help you? No. Did Pharaoh help you? No. He was totally self-serving. Verse 34, or did God ever try to go and take for himself a nation from the midst of another nation by trials, by signs, by wonders, by war, and by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm and by great terrors, according to all that the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes? To you it was shown that you might know the Lord himself is God. There is none other besides him. He's trying to beat it into their head. You serve me. I'm one God. There are no others. Out of heaven he let you hear his voice that he might instruct you on the earth. He showed you his great fire and you heard his words out of the midst of the fire. And because he loved your fathers, therefore he chose their descendants after them. And he brought them out of Egypt with his presence and with his mighty power, driving out from the nation of before you nations greater and mightier than you to bring you in, to give you their land as an inheritance as it is this day. Therefore, know this day and consider it in your heart that the Lord himself is God in heaven above and on the earth beneath. There is no other. You shall therefore keep his statutes and his commandments, which I command you today, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, and that you may prolong your days in the land which the Lord your God has given you for all time. If we could remember that, Israelites did not remember that as they traveled throughout the desert for 40 years. But if we could remember these things and keep our eyes focused on the goal and remember who our Creator is, we would be so much better off. Personally, as a church, as a nation, it would be good if we could remember who the true God is. Our society knows every God but the true God because he's been extricated from our midst. We must not allow him to be extricated from our lives. We must fight for that and fight. We're fighting within ourselves. It's the war between sin and righteousness, and we have to stay with it and fight it daily. It doesn't matter what society is doing around us. It doesn't matter what culture we came from. I did a series of Bible studies where I tried to show different people out of the Bible. Abraham came from his baggage. David had baggage. Paul had baggage. All these people had things and issues. All of us come from different backgrounds, and God takes all of us and throws us into the same pot, and he says, you have one God, one set of laws. Do as I say, It doesn't matter. All y'all follow me. I am the one true God. Don't need to rewrite laws. We don't need to try to come up with something new and different. God's laws are good. Romans 7, verse 12. Romans 7. About three chapters here that are worth spending a bunch of time on, but we're not going to right now. Romans 7, 12. It says, therefore the law is holy. You know, it's God-breathed. The things that God is trying to do for us, it is for our good. God loves us. The law is holy and the commandment. The law is holy and the commandment holy and just and good. It's not just, it's close enough, it'll do. It is holy and just and good. So if you don't want to obey the commandments, if you don't want to obey the commandments, they're still holy, just, and good. Doesn't mean because you don't want to observe a commandment, that doesn't mean the commandment's bad. That means, in your opinion, you don't want to keep it. An opinion is not an adequate basis for law. It's my opinion against yours. Opinion is not how we form laws. That's what I would expect Pharaoh to do. Pharaoh had an opinion, and he exercised it. For instance, I might have an opinion. I think theft is good. I think anybody that wants to steal, that's just fine. Just go for it. Taking something is fine. There will be no consequence. In fact, we'll leave it up to you, and we might even give attaboys for who can steal the most. Now, your opinion might be, I worked hard for this, and I think the law should be, you should not be allowed to steal. That should be punishable by law. There should be some punishment if you steal something. Well, whose opinion is correct? If you leave God out of it, whose opinion is correct? It at some point becomes a circus, and you're chasing your tail. And so if you can get 51% of the people to say stealing is bad, then the 49% has to kind of back down and wait till the next election cycle. Who's right? Well, God says what's right, but that's not what we want to, that's not how we like it. In Egypt, the law was obey me or die. Were God's laws good in their eyes? Well, I think that in the beginning, I think the grass was kind of greener on the other side of the fence. God said, take a lamb and kill a lamb. Oh, great, we'll do that. All right, pack up your families and take a walk in the desert. Okay, yeah, let's do that. Get us out of here. But when the honeymoon gets over, then they're saying, what gives you the right to tell us what to do? We don't think you're telling us. We think that this is unfair. Turn to John 3. They had to learn that the true God was one of love, that he sets the rules, and the rules are for their good. John 3, verse 15. You know, the God that wrote this in John 3 was the same God that was telling the Israelites what to do. John 3 and verse 15, I'll break into it. It says, John 3, 15, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. God's not against the Egyptians, except the Egyptians as they break his laws and don't do as he says. He's not against the Americans and Britons. He's against the sin. He loves the people, but he doesn't love the sin. Verse 18, he who believes in him is not condemned, but he who does not believe is condemned already because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. And this is the condemnation, that the light has come into the world and men love darkness rather than light. That's what we have today in our society, because their deeds are evil. For everyone practicing evil hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his deeds be exposed. I think in the heart of the vast majority of people, they know right from wrong. They know that they are anti-God, but they just don't want to admit it, and since God doesn't strike them with lightning, they think they can get away with it, and that it's all okay. Verse 21, but he who does the truth comes to the light, that his deeds may clearly be seen, that his deeds may be clearly seen, that they have been done in God. So the Israelites were experiencing God's love in physical ways. And that's generally where love starts. How else is God going to express his love to them? He takes care of them. Gets them out of bondage. He protects them. He puts the fire by night and the cloud by day. He takes them to a land flowing with milk and honey. He saves them from foreign enemies. He wipes out the people as they come to the land. He allows them to go in without having to put up much of a fight. He saves them from the enemies. God couldn't do enough for them to make them want to obey. And Deuteronomy 5:29, let's might as well read it accurately. Deuteronomy 5:29. God knew it wasn't in their heart to obey him correctly. They just couldn't get the big picture of how much God loved them. God was so restrictive, so authoritarian, but God was so right. Deuteronomy 5:29 says, oh, that they had such a heart in them that they would fear me and always keep my commandments, that it might be well with them and with their children forever. No, they wouldn't do that. They couldn't keep his commandments and his statutes and his laws. They had to stray and wander. So we have the same dilemma today. As was said in the sermon, that we have to worry about our own selves. We have to, you know, the question is, will I listen to God's voice? If I was back in Egypt, would I be pro-God or pro-Egypt? Would I be saying, let me go back and partake of the leeks and garlics and stuff? So do we hear God's voice as he said in Deuteronomy 4? You know, the law is a safety net. And if we stay inside the net, chances are we're not going to get injured, either physically or eternally. I'm as a father, I'm always amazed at how, you know, the children want to, you know, if there's a cliff there, it says, don't go beyond this line. And it's like, just a little bit beyond this line. And we all want to just like, how far can I go before it doesn't go so well? I was on a construction site Friday, and I was happened to walk into a safety meeting, and I could just feel the disdain towards the guy that was giving the safety meeting. He's saying, you got to wear your eyeglasses and your safety glasses and your hard hat, and if you're working with chemicals and things that are going to damage you, you know, you have to read the MSDS and you need to take these precautions. And the guys are standing there like, whatever, you know, I can mix methyl ethyl ketone and no one, you know, whatever. And all their, I mean, they have to be there, they have to hear, yeah, whatever. Because you know, as soon as the guy walks out the door, and as long as OSHA's not around, they're not going to have the hard hats on and their safety glasses on. What's wrong with not getting injured? God says, do this and it'll be well with you. No, we don't want it that way. We want to do our own thing. So God's laws free you. It's not that you're free to sin, but you don't have to do that. You're not supposed to sin. God's saying, don't sin. So because of Christ's sacrifice, we are freed from sin. We're not shackled by that sin. We're freed from the penalties of sin. We don't have to be under that curse. John 8. John 8, verse 31. You know, wrong with having a good life and obeying God, and God says, do this and I'll bless you, and it's like, what's wrong with that? No, people want to have their own version of that. Let's see how far over the line we can go without it, without the edge of the cliff falling off. John 8, verse 31 says, then Jesus said to the Jews who believed him, if you abide in my word, you are my disciples indeed. And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. And they answered him, we are Abraham's descendants and have never been in bondage to anyone. How can you say you will be made free? And Jesus answered them, most assuredly I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin. And a slave does not abide in the house forever, but a son abides forever. Therefore, if the Son makes you free, you shall be free indeed. And through Christ's sacrifice, he has forgiven us of that death penalty, and we have the opportunity to continually go to him and ask forgiveness when we see that we have slipped up and made a mistake. So the law is there, but it's still your personal prerogative to say, I'll keep it, I'll do it, even if it's not normal, even if my friends aren't doing it, even if it feels weird because, you know, day of unleavened bread, how am I going to explain that to my cool friends? It's not something that you'd say, yeah, well, that sounds great, I'll do that. But God says it's one law for all. There's one God, one law, and this is how it should be. In a recent BT Daily, it's actually March 10th, the presenter was discussing the validity of the Bible, and his comment was, you can ignore it if you like. You know, the Bible is there, the validity of the Bible is there. You can say, I don't believe it, but that doesn't change the fact that the sun's going to come up tomorrow morning and that the earth is still spinning as it should, and that when they say that there's going to be a blood moon at 11:57 on the night a week ago, that sure enough, when you look out there and you set your clock and you walk out there at 11 whatever, and yep, sure enough, the laws, there must be some laws going on in this universe because some scientist was able to figure out when that eclipse was going to happen, and the moon went away when it was supposed to, and it came back when it was supposed to, although I didn't stay up to watch it come back, so I just took their word for it. So, whether you believe the Bible doesn't change the Bible and doesn't change the law, it only affects how you live. So if you're looking for an excuse to set up your own laws and preferences, it doesn't matter where you get your basis for law. God's law stands. And if you want to make up something else, then that's not God's law, it's your own thing. And you know, Mr. Mickelson in a sermon a couple months ago talked about there are two classes of people. There are believers and non-believers. So believers believe God and they try to observe what's commanded and what's in the Bible. And then there's everybody else, non-believers. And we have a lot of non-believers. So the law has to be in place for the universe to perform, for the heavenly bodies to do their thing, for the living processes to work, for us to grow and regenerate and procreate and all these things. These things didn't just evolve. You can personally say that's bunk. Like, whatever. That doesn't change the law, does it? Still going to work as the Creator has dictated that it does. Ecclesiastes 8 and verse 11, I kind of sort of referred to this earlier, but I think this is one of the most, I don't know, I shouldn't say meaningful scriptures in the Bible because that's not true, but this scripture is so true that Ecclesiastes 8 and verse 11, we have to remember this and in our own personal lives and the lives of our young people, and we have to remember this. Just because you don't get hit with lightning doesn't mean that it's an acceptable thing to do. Verse 11, Ecclesiastes 8, because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, Therefore, the heart of the sons of men is fully set to, in them to do evil. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and his days are prolonged, yet I surely know that it will be well with those who fear God, who fear before him. And it will not be well for the wicked, nor will he prolong his days, which are as a shadow, because he does not fear God. So, just because we do things, Mr. Petty talked on Sabbath about little sins. Just because we don't do things doesn't mean that that's okay, because lightning didn't come down and hit us. That doesn't mean anything. God is still watching. As I look around, I see examples, and when I read the newspaper, I'm struck by examples of how God is being pushed out of our lives. In a Reader's Digest, March 2014, there's an article about sobering up. It has to do with women and Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, in the old days, Alcoholics Anonymous was a good thing, but one of the things that really bugs people is that, step 4 or something talks about having to submit to a higher power. Oh no, that's not going to work in my life. You know, it's me and God, or it's not me and God. I'm not going to submit to a higher power. I'm my own power, and I'll do what I feel. And so people think Alcoholics Anonymous was too restrictive. So they come up with groups so that you can still drink and take care of your family too. You just have to budget your time better and decide that this month you'll drink and next month you won't. And kind of make it work for your lifestyle. You're not telling me what to do. It limits my lifestyle choices, and I don't like that. Proverbs 16:25, we don't have to go there. There's a way that seems right unto man, and you're still going to die. One of the things I've already talked about a little bit is marriage and the family. This has really come under assault. And of course, because that's what God wants in our lives. He's trying to show us that there's going to be an eternal family, that God's trying to make a family, that this whole thing is about family. God loves us, and he's trying to recreate. Many people don't understand traditional marriage. It's like, what do you mean traditional? What's an acceptable marriage or not an acceptable marriage? Well, I think that marriage is between two nouns. Man and a cat, woman and a horse. You know, it's like, why stop at two? Why not have 6? You know, marriage was set up by God. Anything that's not of the definition that God used is not marriage. You could call it something else. It may be similar. You may still walk down an aisle, but it's not marriage. It's something less than marriage. It's not what God set up and what he intended to be in our lives. But the scary part is that these attitudes and concepts sneak into the church. And the way I see it sneaking into the church is that young people are learning and have learned to distrust marriage. They see parents falling apart. They see their friends falling apart. They see their other young adults in the church, marriage not working. And it scares them. Here's a priceless institution that God created to just be a wonderful experience, and people are afraid to go into it because other people are making it look trashy and cheap. And it's all around us, and it influences our thinking, and it's not right. So man tries to redefine marriage, and it doesn't work. In a Dear Abby, Coeur d'Alene Press, Friday, April 11th this year, in a Dear Abby article, the writer is questioning an attitude in marriage where each mate thinks that he or she should be free to do with their own money as they want. So I make money, you make money, I'll share it if I want to. I want you to share it, but I don't want to share mine. In a traditional marriage, historically, most of us are used to the idea that, you know, the money goes into the kitty, and then we decide how to pay the bills And if there's any left over, then we decide what to do with that. Well, that's not the way it is for a lot of people. Money, people want to keep their own money. So Abby's reply to me was worth noting. She says, "You have raised an interesting subject. There is a difference between living together and being married because of our legal system." And so I'm in brackets, I'm saying the assumption is that the legal system has defined marriage. No, God defined marriage. The legal system has another interpretation of it. Because people who cohabit without benefit of marriage are considered individuals in the sight of the law, meaning if you cohabitate, you're not married in the sight of the law, it is probably prudent to keep your financial affairs separate. However, each person should contribute to the expenses they share. Well, that's, you know, you got to be nice to each other, right? She goes on to say, in a marriage, the situation is different. The law assumes that the man and wife are one unit. This is the mindset you adopted when you and your wife were married. She goes on, there is a tendency among young couples, not only because of the high divorce rate, but also what they have been exposed to in the media from the time they were born, to view marriage as something that might not last. And I'll tell you what, you're doomed in your marriage if you go into it with that attitude. She says, there's also a sense of entitlement among many, not all, that makes them centered on themselves. We have become a society in which disposability has spread from material possessions to relationships. Like this, what do you mean one, you know, before God until death do us die? Like, that's not in our marriage contract. She finishes up by saying, I would love to hear what my readers, and particularly my young viewers, views are regarding this. So she's asking for the public to weigh in on this. And I'd say, who cares what the public thinks? God's the one that defined what marriage is. And anybody else, it's just opinion. So these are big questions for our young people today. People, our young people, none of us want to fail in marriage. And if you're not married, there's always this fear in the back of your mind that if I pick the wrong guy, it might fail. Well, it is true that we do have to pick the right mate. And but if both mates are trying to submit and live by God's laws, we're going to have a very good chance of having a good marriage. So people don't want to fail in marriage. And at the same time, I see that people don't want to sacrifice themselves to the ways of the world. So we don't want to get married and have it crash, and I don't want to go live with somebody, so I just end up staying single. And this struck me a few months back as I looked at our roster, how many single people there are in the church. And it's like there are all these good people in the church that could get along and probably could be married, but everybody's like afraid to do it. And it's a bit sad. But you can't do it according to the world standards. You have to do it according to God's standards. And then you have to work on it like you intend it to last, not having an escape clause or a get-out-of-jail-free clause. Recently, we went to see the movie God's Not Dead. It's a movie about evolution and creation. It's actually nice to be able to stand up here and say that there's a decent movie out there, and one that's standing up and promoting God. After we saw that, I was watching a evening news or some kind of a news show, and the anchorman twice in the introduction of this particular bit, he twice referred to my distant cousins, meaning it was apes or something like that, and I'd never met them before, so I didn't. So, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, why have rules? Well, God says there are rules, and we can't like undo that. But in our society, not having rules is called anarchy. And that's basically what people want, is controlled anarchy. We want to have anything I want to do needs to be allowed, and if what you want to do doesn't agree with what I want to do, then I don't want you to do it. And this affects our lives in so many ways. Last weekend we were down in Kennewick, and it was lunchtime. I still had about 4 hours to eat leavened bread, and so I found a fast food joint that I thought would be safe. And on the way into the fast food joint, 1 foot away was the door to the cannabis supply shop. Now, do I need to explain to you that cannabis is marijuana? Okay, so I can either decide to eat lunch or get high. Most people have the marijuana, then they eat the lunch. Sorry. Activities that they almost impeached the President of the United States for 20 years ago are now accepted, and that really doesn't make sense. God's laws don't work that way, do they? God's law is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Man's law kind of changes depending on where the wave of controversy goes. So here's my SPS for the day. Where do you get your concept of law? You get your concept of law from man's systems or God's systems? Do you try to mix the two? Do your actions prove who is your lawgiver? Where do you get your concept of law? I'm not going to go into it, but Isaiah 45, I didn't count how many times God said, I am the Lord and there is none other. Isaiah 45, it'd be good for you to read it and see how many times God says, I am the Lord. And he says, every knee shall bow. And we know that the time is coming that every knee shall bow. And it's not in our best interest to push that line and to keep trying to see how much we can get away with. It's not good for us. God's laws are based on love, and they're holy and just and good, as opposed to man's laws, which are not holy and not just and not good. So appreciate what God is doing for us, even when it's not fun, even if you don't exactly see the end in sight yet, when maybe it's more challenging than we really like. Know that God's ways are and his laws are holy and just and good, and that God has a plan for us. And that if we strive to live by every word of God and keep our nose clean and keep our relationship with God up and don't begrudge the process, God is working with us and he's trying to build a family, and we have an eternity in store with God. Brethren, we know that God's ways work. Just work at it and live your life like you intend to have God's ways working in your life. Because God does love us, and his laws are perfect.